This is Bob Dobbs, and it's May 29th, 2015. We're doing part six of our ongoing conversation with Dennis Young. Dennis Young is the Professor Emeritus of Art History at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. We are looking at his essay called Painting and Its Paradigms, which can be read at dennis-young.ca. And there you can see among a list of many articles and increasing inputs by Dennis, a particular long article called Painting and Its Paradigms. Now, we're taking a digression from that. We've done most of the article in the previous recordings, but we digressed into a theme, Dennis's unique theme on how art at the end of the 19th century, going into the 20th century, was inspired either by poetry in general or by architects. That's poets of that period, late 19th, early 20th century, or the other school architecture of that period. One of the most powerful or influential schools in architecture was the Bauhaus, but there were other architects too. We've done various phases of that. Now we're going into a phase called Surrealism. So, hello, Dennis.
Hello.
How would you begin our theme, poets versus architects? Is surrealism influenced by architecture, poetry, or both?
I think we have to go back into the 19th century briefly and have a look at some things that the people who formed surrealism were aware of and had read and understood. In other words, there was a sort of tradition. So we should do that, I think, first. Now, we have talked about this association with poets as applying to futurism and Dada, and now still to surrealism. In futurism, you remember, it didn't start with more than really one poet, but he was a poet. He didn't make visual art, and that was Marinetti. And the Dadaists, while they too were not famous poets, they were at least entertainers, and they appeared in various cabarets and that kind of thing. So what we're really talking about is not a huge group of poets in either case, but a literary emphasis on the beginning, both of Futurism and of Dada. Now, the people who belonged to Dada, a few of them anyway, outlasted its history, which was pretty short. By the time you get to 1922, there's really not much left of the Dadas, because, in a way, the Dadaists were nihilistic. They were, in a sense, self-destructive, and almost consciously so. They didn't want to create works of art that went into auctions and made a lot of money for them or anything like that. They had something else to say about the First World War, and it was very negative. Well, the Surrealists had something of the same to say at the beginning, and in a certain way they started as Dadaists. But they were very much more also poets. And so we have whole books of their poetry. It took a long time for any of their work really to be translated into English. And this is one of the reasons why the Anglophone individuals and Anglophone art historians and so on are not really that familiar with it, or were not until maybe in the last 20 to 30 years. But by that time, Surrealism was over. Everyone, I think, agrees to that. Of course, we still have a kind of language. The English language has adopted the word surreal. You often hear people, when they're being interviewed on the radio these days, and we have heard this for a long time, they say, well, it was kind of surreal. I think when they say that, they have an idea of what they mean, and the idea isn't ridiculous. They mean it was very strange. it gave them maybe a jolt that they didn't expect as well. Well, if that is so, and I think it is, even though they don't know anything about the history of these people who called themselves surrealists, nevertheless, they seem to be using the word reasonably. It's into the language now. It's into the Anglophone language. Well, now, there are several ways of approaching this topic. You're no sooner well into one than you realize that maybe you've got to change boats and start the other. So I hope listeners will forgive me if I say, well, and now I want to change to something else and do such and such.
That's okay with me. You can change boats.
Okay. What the Surrealists set out to do, really, was to be positive where the Dadaists had been negative. They weren't out for destroying themselves, as in a way, certainly, the Dadaists were. You remember any group of people who, just after the First World War in Germany, would pin up outrageous pictures of the army and of the wounded that had come back and so on, they would have stood a real chance of being invaded by the cops and beaten up themselves. But they went ahead and did it anyway. And in fact, they didn't get too much beat up. However, thinking back to the futurists and the so-called futurist evenings that they held, we recall that although this was before the First World War, what they were doing was negating all the art and academics and art historians that had gone before them. They talked about burning down the museums even, and they said those kinds of aggressive things. So the futurists had that overtone of destruction. And the Surrealists, as they came to call themselves, picked up on that. Let me also just indicate a few of the sources of their later thinking, which were a product of the 19th century, because they made a lot of fuss about Sigmund Freud. They claimed, or at least their leader did, and maybe it's worth just saying, that they did have a leader, just as the futurists had a leader in Marinetti. They had a leader in André Breton, who was sometimes called the Pope, even, because he acted rather like the Pope in dismissing people from his entourage and sometimes even accepting them back again if they played the game that he wanted. And, of course, there were quarrels and fights about that, but he maintained his leadership. He was a fairly aggressive character. I don't mean physically aggressive, though I think he could stand up for himself, but he was certainly a vocally aggressive individual. As I said, they did take a liking to the notion that Freud brought up most visibly, but he really wasn't alone in talking about the unconscious. They seemed to take him up because he was better known across the world in the end as the person who could tell you a lot about the unconscious. But before him, and sometimes his teachers, there were people who wrote things that many have never heard of. There's a fellow called Régis. These are all French. He wrote a book called Précis de Cicatrix, and he mentioned something that the Surrealists were to take up, which was automatic writing. That was in 1887.
And how do you spell his name?
R-E-acute-G-I-S, Régis, or Régis if you want to put the S on.
Okay.
Most Frenchmen wouldn't. It's called A Précis of Psychiatry in English translation, of course. So he talked about automatic writing, and it lay there for them to find out and get enthused about. And then there was the very famous name, Pierre Janet, who wrote a book called The Automatism Psychologique. It was a sort of a more compendious book than Reggie. And he talked about mediumistic writing and automatic writing, too.
And how do you spell his name?
J-A-N-E-T, Pierre Janet.
I see. Now, is he influenced by the Theosophical movement at the time?
No, I wouldn't say so. Those two, and then I'm going to just mention Freud, those two were the kind of people who had been brought up as medical specialists in psychiatry. Mm. There was psychiatry in the 19th century. I mean, a lot of people may not think about it that way, but there was. And during the 19th century, we see quite an important growth of understanding of what mental illness was and that it shouldn't be treated as it had been in previous centuries, where if you were diagnosed as having a mental disorder, you could actually be chained up in some awful hovel, worse than if you had committed a crime.
Yes.
By the end of the 19th century, there was some light being shone on the problem. And all through the 19th century, there are small little areas where some psychiatrist or other decides, this is ridiculous. I'll have everyone in the asylum to my place to tea at three at a time, you know.
Yeah.
And this kind of thing happened, and everyone came to tea, and they were all polite. There was nothing wrong with that moment. So there was a lot of enlightenment going on, but of course, I mean, even today, there's a limit on the enlightenment. But in the hands of Freud, of course, it became infamous because Freud associated a lot of the problems of people with their sexual development. And, of course, he had some insight because women came to him with troubles. And this was common, actually, among psychiatrists of the late 19th century. I don't know whether Freud ever employed it, but other psychiatrists did employ it. They had a little vibrator, and they made their female patients lie down, and they gave them an orgasm, which was often viewed as not so much as simply a sexual pleasure, but as a way of getting rid of mental problems, which to some extent it was. Anyway, when Freud began to write, that kind of discourse began. One of the techniques Freud used, of course, was what he called free association. The client lay on a couch and was encouraged to speak as if no one was in the room. That's why Freud sat behind him or her. And he would encourage the person, if the person stopped, he might even take an opportunity, if someone suddenly stopped, to say, aha, this person stopped on that word or that idea. Now we've got hold of something. Now we've got hold of something in the unconscious, which is affecting them because they stopped.
Yes.
And so Freud would, in his way, which I can't certainly define, he would go on to try to talk around that a moment of the stoppage. So these books, all French, well, Freud was not translated into French very early, actually. So what the surrealists knew of him was less than what they knew of Regis and Janet and others, too, who had written books. Now, besides this interest in the unconscious and automatic writing and mediumistic people and free association, they took hold of those things and decided they were a way to make art which was new. Hold on to that for a moment. Now, as for the writers that were influential on them, there were several, but I'll choose just four. The first one, I think it's the first one in order of their lives, was a man called Isidore Ducasse, D-U-C-A-S-S. E. He called himself the Count of Lautremont, but that was a pseudonym that everyone knew because there had been a book, a fantasy story, written about someone called Lautremont anyway. But that was his pseudonym. Now, he only lived to be 24 years old. His origins are not clear. He had, however, published at least one book called The Songs of Maldoror, M-O-L-D-O-R-O-R. That was published in 1868, and he had some poetry published in 1869. That is not in itself somehow what you might call sane, even. And I'll show you what I mean by that by reading from it. This is a book entitled Maldoror, The Songs of Maldoror. And I'm not sure about the songs. I mean, I don't think there are any actual songs with music attached. So it's not quite clear what he means by that. But this strange name, Lautremont, on page 7 of the book, out of the blue comes this paragraph. One should let one's fingernails grow for 15 days. Oh, how sweet it is to snatch some child brutally from his bed, a child who has nothing as yet upon his upper lip, and wide-eyed to make a pretense of passing your hand smoothly over his brow, brushing back his beautiful hair, then suddenly, when he least expects it, to plunge your long nails deep into his soft breast in such a manner as not to destroy life, for should he die, you could not later enjoy his sufferings. Now, that's an amazing book to take up as a text, and it's not clear to me that they took up that kind of sadistic matter at all, although they certainly enjoyed the Marquis de Sade. What they liked about this guy, Lautremont, and what they liked about de Sade was they were going against the grain. Now, we've heard about going against the grain before when we talked about the writers of the decadent movement.
Yes.
And so we must bear in mind that there was a lot of literature of a similar kind, and there were also pictures. Not, thank God, that awful, but still a lot of pictures that broke new ground and which might have been banned if the censor could have gotten hold of them in time.
Well, this paragraph you just quoted, is that in a prose book, or is it songs in poet style?
No, it's in the style of a novel.
Oh, okay.
Just a novel. There are 337 pages in my copy. And he talks about lots of things. And one of the things he talks about, especially in his poetry, is something that he called a chance encounter. And at one point in one of his writings, he says what was really to become a mantra for the surreal. It's the chance encounter of an umbrella and a sewing machine on a dissecting table.
Yes.
That image is one that knocked out the surrealists, and which they gloried in almost.
The people who become the surrealists, when are they reading Lautremont? Is this during the war, World War One, or after it? When is this kind of happening?
It's not clear to me, but if the book was published in 1868, then it would have been around for some time. It might have been out of print or something. But, of course, Breton was a very literary individual, and living in Paris and able to get his hands on pretty well anything he wanted, I suppose. I don't know if anybody knows how the Chant de Maldoror ever got into his hands. If you have friends who like the Marquis de Sade for his defiance of the rules, then you probably automatically hear someone say, well, what about this guy Lautremont,
yeah.
You know, and the book called Shantamoro. These are just guesses, but you know, you can imagine the kind of thing. Another one that they knew of and which they promoted to sainthood was the young poet Arthur Rimbaud. I think we did mention Rimbaud, did we?
Yes, I'm pretty sure.
At some point along. He died in 1891.
Yeah, and his name is spelled R-I-M-B-A-U-D. R-I-M-B-A-U-D.
Rimbaud. That's right. Yes, Arthur.
So he died in 1891, and the surrealists don't really begin until after World War I, many years later.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Of course, his story was known because he had this sponsor, Verlaine, who had a gay relationship with him for a time before he left for the jungle and made something of a fortune in North Africa and then died of bone cancer in his leg. I thought I might just read something from Rimbaud. It's an extract from a letter that he wrote when he was 16 years old to his teacher, Paul Demenet. He says, and this is entering it somewhere in the middle of the thing. He says, I is someone else. If brass wakes up a trumpet, it is not its fault. This is obvious to me. I witness the birth of my thought. I watch it. I listen to it. I draw a stroke on the bow. The symphony begins to stir in the depths or springs onto the stage. If the old fools had not discovered only the wrong meaning of the I, that is the letter I, we would not have to sweep away those millions of skeletons who, for an infinite length of time, have accumulated the products of their one-eyed intelligence, shouting they were authors. And it goes on like that. Near the end of the page, it says, I say that one must be a seer. This is a very famous statement in literary history. The poet becomes a seer. That's, by the way, S-E-E-R, a seer. A person who sees into the unseeable, if you like.
Yes.
The poet becomes a seer through a long, immense, and reasoned derangement of all the senses, all shapes of love, suffering, madness. He searches himself. He exhausts all poisons in himself to keep only the quintessences. Ineffable torture, where he needs all his faith, all his superhuman strength, where he becomes, among all men, the great patient, the great criminal, the great accursed one, and the supreme scholar. And so he goes on like this.
And that's when he's 16.
That's when he's 16. And, of course, by the time he was 18, he stopped writing poetry. Incredible genius in this guy.
Was he influenced by anybody to write like that? Was he reading spiritual writings? Theosophical stuff? Like what? Why was
as far as I know, he was not.
Wow.
At 16, you know, what can you have read at 16? But I think, you know, there is a sound in it of the fourth dimension, isn't there? There's something about the mind that would cause a psychiatrist to lay him on a couch and see what he really meant and so on. But this has been kept, and it's a sort of sacred idea. And I don't know whether anyone has ever said, well, of course, that's the way I write my poems too. I don't know. But if you read his poems, there really are some really fine, very understandable poems, as good as anything being written at that time.
Well, when he wrote it at 16, was it published when he was 16?
Oh, it wasn't published for ages. It was a letter. It's just a letter to a friend who, after he heard of his student's death he got together a lot of material to sort of act as a historian, so to speak, you know, to keep his name alive because he thought of it so deeply.
This is Rambo or the teacher did that?
The teacher who did
that. And so Rambo's writing is a response to the death?
No. Rambo died in 1891, but he hadn't written a poem for, 28 years or something like that. I could.
But you're saying that Rambo at 16 wrote a poem. Why are you bringing up this death of someone else?
Well, because, again, what he says there is something that the surrealists clung to. He was against everything, obviously, in that letter. And in a lot of the poetry that he wrote as his last poems.
Yes.
So he was a hero. This guy, Isidore Ducasse, was a hero to them. And there was a fellow called Jacques Vacher that Breton had met during the war, and they had exchanged letters. In the end, Vacher committed suicide. But what is interesting about that is, well, first of all, that if we jump back just a tad to Alfred Jarry and Ubu Wa and so on, his absurd plays and his absurd stories, then he's almost like a follower of Jarry. He wants to create new language and sort of humor, but in his case, it's sort of joyless. And you don't think of Jarry as joyless at all. I mean, his books are always very amusing.
Okay, but you're talking about Rambo. He stops writing in 1891. Isn't Jarry writing in 1890s? Is there an influence of Jarry on Rambo?
I'm now talking about another person.
Oh, okay.
I called Vacher, V-A-C-H-E acute. And he met Breton during the war. And one of the reasons he met him, I think, is that, and we're going to get to Breton very soon, is that Breton had been, he was during the war, a medical orderly. And before the war, he claimed to have been a medical student who was interested in psychiatry. And he claimed even to have read Freud, which he couldn't have because he didn't speak any language except French. And there had been no translations when he said he was aware of Freud.
This is Breton you're talking about.
This is Breton, yes,
yeah.
The leader of surrealists.
Right. Now, I need to ask, I don't understand why does somebody gather together materials after some student killed themselves or died. What's the relevance of that?
I'm not sure what your question is.
Well, you were talking about someone who gathered together materials relating to Rambo. Did Rambo gather materials?
Yes. Rambo's stuff was gathered together by his old school teacher.
Ah, that's the point. And that was well after Rambo had died, or was Rambo gone to Africa when that gathering?
I'm not sure, but certainly someone did it. And he had letters from Rambo and got them published at some point.
So you did Vacher, and now you're leading into Breton, but maybe you're naming these people, and they're influencing Breton, and only Breton?
No, they're going to influence Breton and his friends as they accumulate around him. At the moment, we're like still before the First World War,
okay,
where he becomes a medical orderly.
Yes.
And then after the war, these things will become very useful to understanding as we look at Breton. I just wanted to say one more thing about this man, because it's Vacher who wrote to Breton, and Breton who published his letters, just as Rambo's teacher had published his letters after he died. But what is so interesting about it is that this man speaks, and it's like he's been shell-shocked, and it's very difficult to understand. I don't know enough about Vacher, but he wrote several letters to Breton, and he published them on his death. When Breton published them, the title of the publication was Letters from the War.
Right.
So they are to do with someone who is in the war and survives. He says in one of his letters, "I object to being killed in war. to die alone is so boring. Now, this is a typical dandyish thing to say, isn't it?
Yes.
When I die, I shall take one of my best friends with me. And when he was found dead, he was found dead with a friend.
Wow.
Whether that friend had known or not, they both took a huge overdose of opium.
Now, this publishing of Vache is after World War One, and the Surrealist movement has started? Or this is before
no,
that?
No, the Surrealist movement, we're around the point of getting to that.
Yeah. Okay.
So let's just say a little bit more about the fourth person I wanted to mention. And he is, so to speak, the one who begins to start up what's to become Surrealism, although he never joins it because he dies somewhere in 1918 of the flu epidemic. Anyway, his name is Apollinaire, Guillaume Apollinaire, Apollinaire. His dates are 1880 to 1918, so he's 38.
Mm.
Now, Apollinaire was a big figure on the Paris scene of the arts.
I have a question at this point, Dennis. Is Apollinaire talking about Alfred Jarry? Is there Jarry known before World War
I? We can assume that everyone knew about Alfred Jarry. His books are published. I mean, I think a publisher could get hold of his books, even though Jarry died early, of course. But any publisher who got hold of those books would have wanted to publish them because they're so amusing. They are critical, of course, of social life and so on. But they are critical in a comic way.
Now, who is Jarry influencing of the names we've talked about?
Nobody, really.
Okay.
It's more to do that Jarry, like the others, was against, so to speak, the literary directions of his day, let's say.
Yeah.
And these are all people who are now, in a way, celebrated as those who went against the grain. Let me say a thing, too, about Apollinaire. Apollinaire was a good poet and published some good poetry. It's in my opinion. I like reading it. He was also an art critic, and he was a pornographer. That's really where he made his living, as a pornographer. He got involved with Picasso. He got involved with Marcel Duchamp. If you can get involved with both of those guys and be their friend and be invited, and in the case of Duchamp, go on a long drive to the Alps, you know, he's getting around. I mean, I'd just love to have been as good as Apollinaire at getting to know some of the great artists of our time.
People who are going to become artists. He's meeting them before anybody knows of Duchamp, right?
Oh, that's right, yes. Yes, but of course, you only got to meet Duchamp, and I guess, and hear his conversation, get the sense of the man, and the thought comes into your head, I got to know this guy. I mean, I like him. He's an immensely unique person. And I suppose Picasso may well have thought the same. In any case, he wrote about them, and he wrote about them in a positive way at a time when nobody else was doing so.
Right.
However, he was called up to fight in the war, and he did get wounded. And I'm not sure whether it was before or after his getting wounded that he became the editor of something called the Soirées de Paris, Paris Evenings, which would have dealt with the theater and music and so on. Let's just leave it at that, that he was a good poet and a critic who knew everybody, and he made a lot of money. The only way he made any money was as a pornographer. He was arrested when the Mona Lisa was stolen. Did you know the Mona Lisa was stolen from the Louvre in 1911, I think?
Okay.
What he had done was he had given a bed, in a way, in his apartment to some rascal who actually stole things. This fellow, who lived with him for some months, I think. He'd met Picasso, too, through Apollinaire. It was the moment when Picasso was interested in early Spanish, very early Spanish, almost Stone Age Spanish images that were in the museums. Well, the Louvre had a couple of heads, and this guy stole them. He asked Apollinaire if he could approach Picasso, because he thought Picasso would like them. Well, Picasso said, sure, I'll take them. And I don't know whether Picasso knew they'd been stolen from the Louvre, but he took them. So he had them in his hands for about a year or so.
Mona Lisa is not stolen at this point.
No.
So is Apollinaire gave them, sold them to Picasso, or the other guy, the roommate?
They knew each other so well, I don't know which one, but, you know, they would both be culpable, I suppose.
I see, yeah.
Then suddenly somebody stole the Mona Lisa. I don't know who now. I don't know whether they even caught the person who did it. But they simply walked into the Louvre, took it off the wall, and walked out with it under their arm. The Paris press, plus everybody else, I guess, had a lot of fun with the people who were supposed to be looking after the Louvre, the people who stand at the corners and watch everybody, make sure they don't do that. There were lots of cartoons. One of the ones I liked was that someone is outside the Louvre and he's selling things that you can pin on the sleeping
image? Are you saying talking about pinning something on an image?
Well, I mean, the people who should have been looking after the paintings were obviously asleep on their post. So somebody was selling these things that you could buy for a penny, and it said, you know, stick these on to sleep when you find people sleeping in the Louvre, the Mona Lisa. Even in those days, it was very, very famous. So there was a big manhunt, and Picasso thought, oh, my God, I've got something from the Louvre. So he and somebody else, I'm not sure how quite they did this, but what they decided to do, he got two heads. They would wrap up the two heads, go out into the city, put them down somewhere nice and safe, and then they'd drop a note, an anonymous note, to the Louvre to say, you'll find two heads in a certain place.
Right.
Well, they did this, but everybody was then saying, yeah, but you know, it got around a bit that this guy who lived with Apollinaire was, you know, he got crooked fingers. So in the roundup of all the people who might have been associated with the theft of the Mona Lisa, they thought, the cops, when they heard that this guy lived with Apollinaire, they said, okay, we're going to arrest both of them. Which they did, and he actually went to jail for a bit. I think it might have been while he awaited the trial, but I'm not sure. He wrote a poem while he was in jail, which is a very nice, interesting account of being in jail. But in the end, they let him off, and then we have the war. And then we have a play that he wrote. And here we get to Surrealist. Because in 1917, oh my goodness, I should be able to think of the famous play that Picasso and everyone was involved in.
Is the playwright famous at that time, or is he a new guy on the scene?
No, Stravinsky wrote the music, and the great Russian Diaghilev, his troupe danced. And it was there that Picasso met his wife. She was a ballerina. But that's a bit beside the point.
This play, Tom, was written by a French person.
Yes, and I don't know. I don't think it was Apollinaire who wrote it. But he wrote an introduction to it. In that reproduction, he uses the word surreal.
Oh. That's in 1917.
Yes, that's in 1917.
he's discussing the way the performance is. What is surreal? What is he referring to?
If you remember the designs of the characters in the ballet, I think it was a ballet.
Yeah.
Picasso's designs were very difficult to. I mean, no one has ever seen costumes like that. I don't even know whether people could move. They look so much like cardboard boxes. They were.
Does this play become a great play in the history of drama? I mean, every student learns about it.
I think everyone who's interested in this phenomenon of surrealism does, but I don't know whether you could ever see it performed these days.
So the ballet dancers are in boxes?
Well, when you look at Picasso's uniforms for whoever it is that I've seen in drawings, they look as if they find it very difficult to move. It's as if they have to shuffle around. I don't know much about it. I mean, it's certainly in the same tenor as everything that we're talking about, isn't it?
Yes. What does Apollinaire mean by surreal? Under reality? Para to reality?
Well, that's interesting because it's very difficult to say. Surreal means, I think in French, it would be above reality. Obviously, he meant it's not like the everyday real. It's something else.
Yes.
And maybe he was even doing a touch of Madame Blavatsky or someone. I don't know.
Right.
But there comes word. That's an important thing. And at the same time, he published, and it was played, a play called The Tits of Tiresias. Well, Tiresias was a person in the Greek mythology who wanted to experience life both as a man and a woman. I mean, you can see again how this is against the grain. No one would do that, would they?
And this is the same author as the play you're trying to remember? Is that what you're saying? Did The Tits of Tiresias?
This is Apollinaire's.
That's Apollinaire's play.
Apollinaire writes the play.
And he's going to be dead a few months later.
Yes, he is. That's right.
Would Breton have seen this play?
I would think it's possible, though he would have been in the army as a medical person at the time. So if he was home, yes. If he could get home for a couple of days, because the front was only about 50 miles from Paris or whatever, well, you know, he might have. I don't know. But let me just give you a little piece of the story of this. In the play, it is not about Tiresias. That's just the title. The heroine is named Therese. She's a woman. She wants to become a man, and she wants to take part in a man's world. She opens her blouse, and I've seen this play, I must say. She opens her blouse, and her breasts fly up into the air and float away because they're balloons.
Right.
And then she grows a beard, changes her name to Tiresias, the blind bisexual soothsayer of the Greeks, and all the women copy her. So now we've got a situation with the whole of Paris, all men, and the men try to grow babies artificially, since they can't get sex with out of it. This goes on for a little bit, but then, you know, everything begins to break down. The lack of sexual pleasure returns. They say, oh, we can't go on like this. The women say we can't go on like this. Everybody says we can't go on like this. So everything returns to normal.
In the play. This is the play you described.
Yes, in the play. I should say that Apollinaire's motto was, I astonish. And this I astonish is something that the surrealist also took up. And they obviously also borrowed his word, surreal.
Now, when do they do this? Do they do this at the year, the miraculous year of 1922, when Eliot's The Wasteland comes out, Joyce's Ulysses, and other people are making a lot of things happening in 1922? Is this when?
Not really, because what we've got then is what they later on called the epoch flu, which meant well, came to mean, with the historians, came to mean the period between the death or the dying of Dada and the beginning of something else, which was to be called surrealism.
This transitional period's called the Bell Flu, or the Epoch Flu. What did you say?
Yes, the Epoch, E-P-O-C-H, which is like the period, isn't it?
Yeah.
The period of the flow, F-L-O-U, but I think F-L-O-U. But, you know, the translation would be the time of the flowing.
Ah, okay.
That, when nobody was really a Dadaist and nobody was really anything else. So it was Breton who, above everybody, said, this is ridiculous. The Dadaists are dying, and they're dying because of the way they approach the situation of art making and so on. And I'm saying now, he says, basically, we need to have order. We need to have a group. We need to form something that's going to change the world, really. And it's not going to change the world like the architects are changing it, or the abstract painters are trying to change it. It's going to change the world through the unconscious above everything.
Mm.
This is where we, you know, they begin to load their little libraries with stuff about the unconscious and about the methods that have been talked about by Reggie and Janet and so on. So they start a journal. They call it literature, literature. It lasts from 1919 to 1924, and 1924 is the year in which it changes from being a sort of Dadaist journal to being a surrealist journal, because the first appearance of the group as a group with the name as of surrealism comes in 1924. And so this journal, Literature, is changed. The name of it is changed. And it becomes the first issue of the Surrealist Revolution.
So now the Epoch Flow then is about 1922, because Dada goes up to 1718, right? And then they got this journal, and this Dada is 1920?
Yes, it goes on until 1924.
Right, but it's Dadaistic in the first years, and then there's a switch in 24, but it's in this period of the Epoch Flow, which would be about 21, 22.
Yes, that's right. Now we have a journal which has been publishing stuff by poets and Dadaists and all kinds of people. They're all sitting there ready for Breton to sort of say enough. We're not going to have literature anymore. Actually, the word literature is deliberately there because of a poem that Verlaine wrote and what they wanted to make fun of the poem, but I don't know how many people understood that they were making fun of Verlaine.
Is Rambo published in literature?
No, Rambo, he sort of disappeared. Nobody is bothering with Rambo except for about a dozen people who are involved in literature.
Right.
They, of course, I don't know whether Rambo's writings were being published by anybody. I don't know enough about him. I should read the guy who actually I displaced from a lodging in London, who is the translator, you know, when I was 24.
Yes, in London.
In London, and who is the translator of Rambo?
Ah, okay.
Or the Penguin books.
But that's years later, well after you, he took over your place.
He died 3 years ago.
Oh, okay. But he translated Rambo in the 30s or 40s, something like that, 1930s, 1940s?
No, in the late 50s, early 60s.
Okay.
No, I mean, he was my age. No, not my age. He was a couple of years older, but that's all.
So when he took over your apartment, did you know him?
Oh, yes. He was at Goldsmiths College, and I was at Goldsmiths College.
Oh, I see. Okay.
are we about the only two people in the damn college who was interested in poetry recitals. I became the art editor of the college journal, and he submitted poems to it, his own poems. He was a much more sophisticated young man than I was. He wrote a biography about 20 years ago, which enlightened me about him quite a lot. I had a new respect for him. I didn't know him very well, of course.
And you didn't know he was into Rimbaud and when you were at school with him?
Oh, I didn't. I knew he was fluent in French, but that's all.
Is Breton the editor of literature, and he switches to surrealism? Is there a committee? Why? How come Breton? He's just a medical guy from World War I. How did he get this authority?
I mean, how does anybody get authority? I know how I got it. Pushing my way in, telling people what to do, making them change their mind. I mean, you know, that's the way to do it. That's the way I advise everyone who wants to get on.
That you advise people do that, or that's how you would do it. But he's on the scene. He's known. He's hanging out with these people who will become the surrealists, right?
Oh, absolutely now, because he's into this journal literature. Now, I've got a copy here of the whole issues of La Révolution Surréaliste, the Surrealist Revolution.
You have all the issues starting in 1924.
Yes, bound. And so I'm looking at the very first one that was published. When you open it, you don't see Breton's name, surprisingly, although you do see his name on the next page. But you see the name of a man who's regarded as one of the great poets of the first half of the century in France, Paul Éluard, or Éluard, E-L-U-A-R-D. You know, he's very, very famous poet. So he's in there, and he and two others write a very brief sort of preface, they call it. And what they do is, in the middle of the script that's published there, there's a photo. And the photo looks like something which is covered with a blanket and is tied up with string. You can't tell what it is, but it's always been said, oh, but that is the sewing machine that should be found on the table, on the dissecting table, along with the umbrella. I mean, it's on the front, very first page you ever see of this journal, which is going to revolutionize, or it hopes it is, the making of art and the creation of surrealism.
And they're quoting Count Lautréamont. Do they have his quote underneath it, underneath
yes,
the picture?
Yes, no, they don't, and they leave it as mysterious, you see.
No quotation. No reference to it.
No, we don't know. Everybody thinks it is, but it's because it's got a blanket around it.
Yeah.
It isn't absolutely certain. Let me just read now what they say in the beginning. I mean, this is the first piece of publication under the name of Surrealism. It reads like this: the pursuit of knowledge, having nowhere to go, the intellect having nothing to contribute, the dream alone makes liberty available to man.
Wow. Who's that written by?
This is Éluard with two others whose names I won't give you because they're not well known.
And that is on the page where his name is?
That's on the very first page of the first issue of the journal Surrealist Revolution.
Is the photo of the quote sewing machine on that page, same page?
Yes, yes it is.
I see. Yeah.
And the text goes around it.
Wow, that's pretty neat. I've never seen that. I've seen the photo, and there's no reason to say that photo is of the sewing machine or connected to the Lautréamont. There's no connection.
No, they don't
there.
Say anything. I think they just love to leave the mystery, you know.
Did anybody find out what it is?
I don't know. It could be a sewing machine. You can see there's a sort of rounded bit that might be...
Yes, I've seen it. It has a bit of a head.
You've got it.
Yeah, but is there anybody giving credit for the photo?
No.
What's on the cover of the journal? Just a statement of article titles or nothing?
What you see on the cover generally is in big letters. Well, in this case, you see big letters, La Révolution Surréaliste, the 1st of December, 1924, first year, number one.
And nobody knows the word surrealism at that point, unless they've read Apollinaire. So it's like a word that people wouldn't understand. What is that? What is that?
Exactly. So that's what they're asking. Not sure, yeah.
And that becomes one of the most common plebeian terms of aesthetics in conversation of anybody. People who work at McDonald's, they will use surreal.
Exactly, yeah. I've not finished reading this little translation of this page one.
Okay.
They're saying on this page one, these are our given, you know...
Our doctrine.
Our dogma, yeah, good. That's right. The pursuit of knowledge having nowhere to go, the intellect having nothing to contribute, the dream alone makes liberty available to man. Thanks to the dream, death is no longer something obscure, and the direction that life takes is a matter for indifference.
Wow.
Every morning, in every family, men, women, and children, if they have nothing better to do, it's in caps in the original, tell each other their dreams. We are all at the mercy of the dream.
Amazing.
And we ought to submit to its power during our waking state. It is a terrible tyrant, clothed with mirrors and flashes of light. What is paper and ink? What is it to write? What is poetry faced with this giant whose very muscles are in the clouds? While you look to dream for guidance about the future, surrealism opens the doors of the dream to all who find the night. Surrealism is the place of enchanted sleep. Alcohol, tobacco, ether, opium, cocaine, morphine. But it is also the breaker of fetters. We do not sleep or drink or smoke, and yet we dream. Right at the end, it says, in a separate little box, inquiry. We live, we die. And what part does our will play in all that? It seems people do away with themselves as if dreaming. It is not a moral question that we pose. Is suicide a solution? Reply to the Bureau of Surrealist Research.
No, wait. That's not part of the poem. That's a statement.
Yeah, that's...
Reply? What is it? Reply to what?
Is suicide a solution? Reply to the Bureau of Surrealist Research.
Yeah, and that's Eluard and his buddies get credit for writing that, and it's beside the photo. It goes around the photo.
Yes, that's right.
Wow, what an amazing statement! Is Freud well known at that point?
No.
Are they influenced by Freud when they write that?
Well, we're looking at 1924, not 1911, right?
Yeah.
So it's. More possible they have been reading Freud. In fact, Breton goes to visit Freud at one point, actually sees him. He's made such a name for himself after a few years that he decides to go to see Freud, and then he criticizes Freud, and they exchange letters about where Breton thinks Freud has gone wrong.
You know what this reminds me of? It's the influence of McLuhan on Andy Warhol and people in the late 50s, early 60s that people don't know about. They don't know about McLuhan and and 59, 61, but some of the thinkers, Derrida on that, they subscribed to explorations, which came out in the 50s. And so McLuhan's got the new thought framework. People are influenced by it. Freud was doing that to the intellectuals, to these poets. And the average person didn't know about Freud at that point, correct?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. No, that's what's happening here. Okay, that was great.
Let me just pop this last comment. The second issue of the journal contains replies, and it includes a self-portrait by Vaché, who has killed himself 3 or 4 years before, of course, and quotes from historical figures as well as the surrealist poets. Breton maybe had an affection, he did have an affection for Vaché, and so he doesn't care. People never don't know who the hell is Vaché, because nobody did, of course.
So Vaché, they take something he created, and Vaché is dead by December 1924. He doesn't know his work is going to be used in issue 2.
No, he doesn't know, but I mean, he committed suicide, so it's like saying he doesn't want to live in this world, isn't it? You know,
yes. And so,
everything is too painful.
Yeah, Breton can fit what happened to Vaché into the concept or theme of doctrine of the magazine. That fits.
But, you know, when they say, is suicide the answer, it's not a very positive question to ask. So it's, you know, I mean, I don't think it gives them a very good start.
Yes.
Really, when we get around to more to what the intent of surrealism was, and obviously it was something like orgasm or pleasure or, you know.
Yeah.
And they reckoned in a way that that's how you wrote poetry. You get all that from poetry and get it from other things too.
Yeah, Frank Zappa had a song, and he says, he's making fun of disco, and he says, "Let me commit my social suicide by doing disco."
Yeah, quite.
Okay, so we'll pick it up from there. When we get a chance to talk again, that's really good. I'm glad you used your own library resources there. That's pretty unique. I don't think anybody knows this stuff, who goes to art school now. I mean, maybe they hear about it, but it's a long way away now. So very good retrieval for us, Dennis.
Yes, it is, I hope. Well, good. So this has been very pleasant, a very pleasant hour. Thank you.
Okay, and we will... in part two, we'll see if you can look up the name of the play in some of your literature there. And
yeah, well, I know it now. It's Parade or Parade. Massine did the choreography. Cocteau did the story. Eric Satie did the music, not Stravinsky. And Picasso did the sets. I mean, what a gang.
Wow, but who's the writer? Who's given the writing credit?
It's Cocteau.
And it's Parade with the people doing ballet in boxes.
Yeah, Parade, like our word parade.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think parade is a word that is used outside theaters where the players actually sort of come and do a song and dance or some damn thing to get people to come in, you know.
Oh, it's it's a little performance advertisement.
That's right. I don't know whether... it was being used then, but it used to be used in the old days, you know, in the 19th century,
yeah.
18th century.
Well, that's pretty interesting, because they're saying this is an entree, this is an intro, and you're not seeing what they're introducing you to engage. You're seeing the introduction, the trailer.
Well, yes.
The trailer.
You know, when you think Massine, a great dancer, a Cocteau, I mean, very famous name.
Yeah.
Sarti, very famous, Picasso, very famous, all those contributing to this one piece of ballet.
Wow.
And
yeah.
Apollinaire writes the program note.
Wow. Well, I'm really glad you remembered it. That's a great way to end this. So
yeah.
We'll continue soon. Thank you very much, Dennis.
Okay, thank you too. Bye-bye.